giving these talks for the reasons that you just mentioned. It is the first time I'll be talking about this research, this topic of black holes, in the context of a colloquium. I was asked to give a colloquium, so this is going to be broad. I see that many in the rooms are experts. I hope they don't get too impatient. I'm not here trying to be specific, but rather to sort of give an overview and broad picture of the topic and my own research together. This, of course, is a black hole that many of us have seen in the recent movie by Christopher Nolan. It is not exactly the picture that was provided in the movie, which was tweaked a little to fit the desires of Hollywood. But this is a closely related picture, which is, to my understanding, the closest thing that we have at the moment to the appearance of a black hole as it would appear to an observer not too far from it. Many general relativistic effects go into this picture. One of them is the bending of light rays, where an accretion disk, which is really a disk surrounding the hole, is seen across the hole. And so this part here is really lying behind the hole, and yet an observer sitting in front of the hole is able to see it. There are also luminosity and redshift effects, which are due to the rotation of the black hole. All of these effects are pictured in this awe-inspiring picture that we can find in a paper by Kip Thorne and collaborators. The great relativist Chandrasekhar had this sentence about black holes, which I think is inspiring. Black holes are the most perfect macroscopic objects in the universe. The only elements in their construction are our own concepts of space and time. And indeed, this is one way in which black holes are particularly fascinating objects. There are, in fact, many ways in which they are quite fascinating. One of them is, of course, the fact that by their very definition, one can go into a black hole but never come out. This is a very unique situation in physics, which defines and singles out black holes per se as very special objects. I just showed you before an imaging of a black hole where I told you that although a hole is black, you can see images of objects that are lying behind the black hole through gravitational bending of light rays. In fact, it's better than this. If you look in the neighborhood of a static black hole, such as this one, you can see copies of the entire sky an infinite number of times around the horizon. So in particular, this star here appears copied near the black hole in this point here. Similarly, the red star here is an image of this luminous star over there. The trajectories here correspond to the apparent motion of those stars as an observer would circle around the black hole. So optically, black holes are very special. Causally, they're very special. In terms of time, they're also very special. One can think of a trip near a black hole as a trip to the future due to gravitational time dilation. An observer that would approach the surface of a black hole, its so-called event horizon, at a distance r, would have its time duration between events shifted, multiplied by this factor here, where rs is the radius of the black hole, times this time here, which would correspond to asymptotic observers. And so if you go close to a black hole, stay there for an hour and come back, you might well find your friends age 20 years, perhaps, as in the Interstellar movie. So in that sense, a trip near a black hole is indeed a trip to the future. There's another way, perhaps, in which black holes are really fascinating, and that's they are really small as objects seen from the outside. If we were to shrink the entire mass of the Earth into a black hole, it would be as big as my thumb. But they contain a very large volume inside. So there's this recent computation by Christo Deleu and Rovelli that estimates the maximal volume of a space-like surface within the black hole at a given time t to be linearly growing in time after collapse. And so even though the black hole, after it forms, is static from the outside, it remains dynamical in the inside, and the volume that one can stack up into the black hole keeps growing forever in time. This is another way, I think, in which black holes are very strange and fascinating.
But is this time coordinate?
This is really advanced time. So the V coordinate of relativity. This is one of the ways in which this is a colloquium, and so I'm trying to keep notation to a minimal. but this is the time of asymptotic observers. So asymptotically, this would become the Schwarzschild time or the advanced time, which one can use as a parameter along the event horizon. OK, but for the purpose of this talk, I want to focus on another aspect of black holes, which makes them interesting. And that's how they challenge the sort of heuristic reversibility principle that we are used to in physics. And so loosely speaking, I think one can state it as saying that everything that can be done can be undone. Of course, in principle, and perhaps not in practice, the second law of thermodynamics is here to remind us that in many cases, we cannot track microscopic degrees of freedom. And so what can happen in principle cannot necessarily happen in practice. Yet, it would seem that the laws of physics are consistent with the idea that everything can be done can be undone. So an example is this animation here, where in a very viscous fluid, a very laminar flow, a process that mixes colors in a way that looks indeed very well mixed, very thorough, to the point that one would imagine that there is no way to undo this mixing. In fact, it can be undone. Of course, this is a case, a very particular case, with a very laminar flow. But I'm taking this video here from the University of New Mexico as encapsulating this sort of heuristic principle that we might have and might call the reversibility principle. I'm not trying to state it here as a sharp physical principle, but rather as a source of intuition and construction of physical laws. And so in this talk, I want to try and discuss with you how black hole physics is a challenge in itself to the reversibility principle. In the first part of the talk, I'll tell you about the classical challenges, the challenges that arise from the classical Einstein equations, which describe gravitational dynamics. In the second part of the talk, I'll address whether quantum mechanics has something to say, something to change about this picture. So one of the most important theorems of general relativity is the so-called no-hair theorem, which for the purpose of physicists is indeed a theorem, although mathematically it remains a conjecture for different reasons. And the statement is this one, that all stationary black holes essentially are the same up to two parameters. Those two parameters, of course, are the mass and spin of the black hole. And this is, of course, about the structure of the black hole from the outside. The theorem is not a statement about what happens inside the black hole, and indeed there is no uniqueness theorem for what happens inside the black hole. But from the perspective of outside observers, once they form and settle down to their stationary configuration, black holes are all the same, exactly the same. And so what this means is that they can be described exactly with no approximation. This is a very unique situation in physics where a system can be written down and described fully without any approximation in a single equation. It's not that we are not describing this or that aspect. It's that everything here is being said with just two parameters, mass and spin. And in that sense, black holes are indeed perfect. That's, I think, what Chandrasekhar had in mind in his quote. So very quickly, the structure of rotating black holes that have a mass and a spin is the following. It is an object that has some rotation around an axis, which defines its spin. And to the perspective of observers, the following is true. If you approach this structure, this rotating black hole from the outside, what you find, like I said, is that time starts running slow. The closer you get to the black hole, the slower time starts running compared to other observers that are not as lucky as you are and they are not part of the trip near the black hole. Then there's another region that's called the ergosphere. It corresponds to a part of space near the black hole where any observer must co-rotate. There is no way one can fight against the rotation of the black hole, and so if you're in there, in this blue ergosphere, you must rotate with the black hole. And then there's this red region here, which is bounded by the event horizon, which is called the black hole itself, which properly speaking is the black hole. And that's the place where If you are in there, you must fall in. There's no way you're coming out. So time running slow, rotation, and infall, those are sort of the main features of the physics of black holes as described by the so-called Kerr family of solutions to the Einstein equation. It's interesting to look at how black holes lose their hair, how they get bald. The process of black hole balding is by itself quite interesting. So what's underlying this process is a sort of heuristic Price's law, which states that whatever can be radiated in the structure, in the external structure of a black hole, is radiated in the form of gravitational waves. So in particular, magnetic fields that might be attached to a star, when it collapses, they will be expelled from the black hole so that this configuration here that has magnetic hair is forbidden by relativity. Instead, what forms is a Kerr black hole, which is free of magnetic fields. Similarly, any geometrical shape that the star might have, either because it's square or it has a mountain on top of it, that is radiated away when the black hole forms under gravitational collapse. And so once more, the same structure of a Kerr black hole is formed, whatever the initial conditions here. How exactly that energy that is in the shape or the multiple moments gets radiated away is interesting, because it has parallel tails, and so there is a slow decay, first fast, and then slow tails of decay of all this radiation. Eventually, what happens is a Kerr black hole is formed. But there's lots of interesting physics in this balding process, and part of it is really sort of actively researched at the moment. It's very new, and I want to just give you a flavor of this by telling you about results of Lewis Leonard here at Perimeter and collaborators, where turbulent balding was discovered. So in this, you consider perturbations of a Kerr black hole, which are not only not so small that the first perturbative order matters, but also the second order. And you consider how the first order in perturbation can in fact affect or drive higher orders. From that perspective, the first order in perturbation can act as a driver of a second order in perturbation and produce a parametric instability. So the idea of a parametric instability is that some sort of oscillator, perhaps damped by a damping factor here, gamma, has a frequency that's externally driven by some apparatus. In this case, the apparatus is the first order perturbation of the Kerr black hole, and the oscillator is higher order modes. And one finds, in fact, that under some condition, which I'm going to state in a second, an inverse energy cascade occurs where not only are higher order modes excited by the first order modes, but their energy cascades in an inverse way with respect to turbulence. They start at small scales and they propagate at larger scales. This is what you're seeing here with a very regular initial configuration, which starts getting small scale perturbations, which grow and become large scales eventually. The condition for this behavior to happen is analogous to the condition for turbulence in viscous flows, where the control parameter is the dimensionless Reynolds number. In this case, what is formed is a gravitational Reynolds number, which involves the amplitude of the driving mode, the first order perturbation, as well as its azimuthal frequency and its decay rate. And when the gravitational Reynolds number becomes larger than a threshold, this instability occurs, and one finds that higher order modes exponentially grow before eventually decaying. So this is a logarithmic plot, and the colorful lines correspond to those higher order perturbations through which energy flows from small scales to large scales, all of this in a driving background of the first order mode. A very interesting result, which shows that the black hole balding process is a very rich physical process. There's another way, I think, in which the interaction of a black hole with gravitational waves, the emission of gravitational waves, can be interesting and surprising. And that, again, is recent results called the discovery of black hole kicks. And I'm impressed by this discovery. I just want to share it with you as a sort of physical phenomenon that's worth of interest. Here, the initial configuration is a pair of black holes which orbit one another, emitting some sort of gravitational waves. This process takes away energy from the binary, so the spiral is really an in-spiral, and the black holes get faster and faster as they rotate to one another. Now, one finds that there are spin configurations for both rotating black holes, the sort of the parent black holes, such that after the end of this merging process, when a daughter black hole is formed that has all the sort of the parents black holes as seeds and now forms a new black hole, it can be that this daughter black hole receives a kick, meaning a very large momentum in a direction. So in other words, you can think of this process in the center of mass frame of those two black holes orbiting one another faster and faster, and then suddenly getting kicked away at a very high speed. In fact, in some simulations, as far as 1% of the speed of light, and we are here talking of supermassive black holes, which are enormously massive objects, which can end up having such a huge kinetic energy, 1% of the speed of light. So this is a plot that shows this behavior here, where one is seeing in color the three components of the velocity of the daughter black hole, and black is the magnitude of that velocity. And one finds that, although in the center of mass, not much motion was happening for linear momentum, eventually there is this big kick, and then, of course, the black hole keeps moving at a constant velocity. Here, what is shown is a final velocity of 500 kilometers per second. In fact, in simulations, people have been able to produce up to 5,000 kilometers per second. So that's what I said, the order of 1% of the speed of light. And there are even candidates now in the sky of black holes that seem to have been expelled from their mother galaxy and be wandering around in free space. CID 42 is an example where one finds that there are two centers in the galaxy with some eccentricity, and one of the two appears to be a black hole that is being kicked out of the galaxy at very high speeds. So in other words, the black hole balding process and all the physics that goes into forming a hairless bald black hole is really sort of strongly dynamical and quite interesting by itself. There's another sense in which black holes undergo some form of irreversible behavior. And that is dictated by the area law of Hawking. Statement being that the area of a black hole can never decrease. Of course, there's an asterisk here. There's always an asterisk. And here the asterisk is the area of a black hole can never decrease when interacting with normal matter. And I'll come back to this idea of normal matter. So I told you that black holes have two parameters, mass and spin. Here I'm plotting as a function of mass and spin iso area curves. Okay, so the area is the area of the event horizon. And any transformation that will take a black hole from one point on a curve to another is reversible because it doesn't increase its area. So all of these lines correspond to reversible black hole transformations. Perhaps by spinning up a black hole, you can increase its spin so it goes up. And then you can spin down the black hole, goes down. So long as you remove on those curves, this is a reversible transformation. But on the other hand, if the area of the black hole is increased in the process, so that some of these lines get crossed in the process from the left to the right, what you have is an irreversible transformation, because according to the area law, there's no way you can undo this process. Roughly speaking, one sees that reversible processes are the ones that, roughly speaking, once more, add or remove spin, almost at constant mass. And irreversible processes are the ones that correspond to adding mass to the black hole. Because as you can see, as mass is added at constant spin, the area must grow. The area is a monotonic function of mass at constant spin. So another way in which black holes have irreversible behavior, they can be transformed from one configuration of mass and spin to another. But in some cases, this can never be undone. So to summarize the picture of classical irreversibility that I've presented to you so far, I'll say this. One should imagine starting from an initial configuration of matter, which might be a massive star, which might be a neutron star binary, or it might even be a stellar cluster that would undergo core collapse and perhaps form a supermassive black hole. In any case, the process of balding goes on once collapse is ignited, so that from this configuration or this, the balding process and emission of gravitational waves takes the system to one of these very special configurations in the two-parameter curve family represented here by this plane. The line here corresponds to extremal black holes, the black holes that rotate as fast as can be. And so in the infinite dimensional space, if you'd like, of possible initial configuration, gravitational dynamics of the black hole, if one disregards all the gravitational waves that are emitted, appears to be strongly attracted towards this surface corresponding to the stationary black holes. So this is one aspect of the irreversible gravitational behavior towards black holes. And then this arrow here corresponds to possible black hole transformations, changing mass, changing spin. And it has to be, like I said, from the left to the right. It can never be from the right to the left, because that would decrease the area of the black hole. So this picture here, this diagram, is sort of a summary of some of the ways in which black hole dynamics appear to be irreversible. There's yet another way, which is that from the perspective of observers in a black hole, now in a black hole spacetime. Now, instead of considering the dynamics of spacetime itself, the dynamics of the black hole, let's focus on what would be the case as far as observers wandering around the spacetime would be. Okay, so part of our understanding of this problem here is driven by the singularity theorem of Penrose and Hawking, stating, roughly speaking, that all black holes contain singularities. And again, the asterisk here is that this is under the caveat that black hole contains normal matter and not abnormal matter, of which I'll give examples later on. So what this says is really that an enfolding observer that goes into the black hole and is just bound to fall towards the center of this black hole is bound to run into trouble in finite time. This is what the term singularity here means. And again, I know there are experts in the room, so I'm using this heuristic definition to keep the discussion broad and general. But of course, the nature of this trouble that can happen is just left unspecified by the singularity theorems. Singularity theorems tells you trouble is awaiting. It doesn't tell you what happens to you when trouble comes. And indeed, those old insights have stood for a long time. And it has been only recently, I think, that sort of genuinely more specific understanding of what happens as the singularity is approached has been reached. And that is in part thanks to the work of Eric Poisson at the University of Guelph, but also Israel and the mathematical relativity community, especially through the work of Daphermos. So the old idea was, as you enter the black hole and reach that singularity, time and space will end. And what you will reach is what's called technically a space-like singularity of the type that is seen in a static spherical black hole. But in fact, more careful computations suggest that that's not the generic situation. The generic situation is that of null singularities that lie inside the black hole, null meaning having this shape here in a Penrose diagram. So if you're familiar with this picture, great. If you're not, don't worry about it. The idea is that, to the best of our knowledge, it is likely that space-time at the singularity can be continued continuously, although perhaps not smoothly. That curvature, of course, blows up there, becomes infinite, and curvature is like tidal forces. But what matters to an observer isn't the force, it's the work done by the force. So it's the integral of curvature, and this is what might be called tidal with disruptions. And it might well be in those cases that tidal disruptions remain finite at the weak null singularity inside a black hole. Now, this null singularity forms what's called a Cauchy horizon. And that's the limit of predictability of spacetime. And so what might happen, in fact, again, to the best of our knowledge, is that perhaps spacetime is continuable, extendable inside the black hole. But when it is, so that an enfolder can actually go and cross the Cauchy horizon, it will emerge in a part of spacetime that is not determined by initial conditions. And so if this picture is true, it's a conjecture, and many aspects of it have been proved mathematically. The best of our understanding of what happens inside a black hole is that there might be an unpredictable other universe inside the black hole. Quite an interesting new insight, which again shows that research in black hole physics remains dynamic, even though 40 or 50 years have passed since the very first seminal insights of Penrose, Hawking, and others. This closes my sort of first part, where I wanted to present to you several ways in which dynamics in a black hole or of a black hole can be irreversible. But now I want to ask, we know, of course, that nature isn't classical. There are limitations to the validity of classical general relativity. And in fact, it is quantum mechanics which might perhaps enter the game at some critical stage and perhaps affect this picture. And so I'd like to investigate how quantum mechanics has a chance, in fact, to affect the picture. And so the setting that I'm in here is that of semi-classical general relativity, where matter is not assumed to be classical, to be normal anymore. Instead, it is assumed to arise from quantum mechanics, quantum fluctuations of a field. The main phenomenon that arises in this respect is that of Hawking radiation, Hawking evaporation. And I would like to try and explain to those of you who might not be familiar with this idea what the Hawking phenomenon is all about, at least in my understanding. And for this purpose, let me show you this video, and I would like you to focus on the very last moments in that video, which is, of course, a cartoon of the collapse of a red supergiant, of a big star, into a black hole. The very last moments are of relevance here. At the end of the life of the star, it has exhausted its nuclear fuel. It starts collapsing, running into a supernova, a super energetic event, and then a black hole forms, and you see the luminosity of the black hole of the star going down to zero, the star getting redder and redder, dimmer and dimmer, until it becomes invisible. What happens there is that the light that comes from the collapsing star gets what we say exponentially redshifted. It becomes more and more red and more dim. So from the perspective of an observer that's watching this process, it is like the light signal coming from the black hole, the existing black hole, gets transformed according to sort of this rough picture here. This is a classical picture for now, where I'm showing sort of the light signal, the vibration of one component of the electromagnetic field. Its frequency, as you can see, becomes greater and greater until it doesn't oscillate at all anymore. This is, of course, an effect of time dilation in the neighborhood of the black hole. This outcome in light, just before the black hole forms, gets to feel the sort of very deep gravitational potential there is in the neighborhood of the 2B horizon. And as it does this, it undergoes time dilation, and so it comes out very much delayed and slowed down. So this is the picture of a signal emanating from an incipient black hole. This is what you would see classically, but in fact, even if there wasn't anything in the universe, even if the star wasn't emitting classical radiation, there would still be something around the black hole. And that something would be the quantum vacuum itself. The quantum vacuum is a state of a quantum field that has no particles. And so if I plot the particle distribution initially, before the collapse happens, everything is in the zero particle mode. There is no particle in the vacuum by definition. But here, you see this process. It's a strongly dynamical process, a sort of adiabatic process that is applied to a quantum system. And it results in a different state, a state that has the following particle distribution. It comes in pairs. You see that there is a certain probability to find the system in a two-particle state, 4, 6, 8, never 1, 3, 5. And each one of these pairs is what's called a Hawking pair. So this you can think of as a non-adiabatic, sort of rapid change undergone by a quantum oscillator. And that non-adiabatic change induces transitions to excited states. And those transitions are described by this particular particle number distribution. One can be slightly more specific about the structure of the state in the vacuum that gets produced in this parametric process. It is what is called a two-mode squeezed vacuum state, which one can think of as follows. Consider a two-mode quantum oscillator. So two modes A and B with positions xA and xB and momentum pA and pB. And the blob here, the blue blob, corresponds to the wave function of that two-mode system in the vacuum. It is a Gaussian centered on zero, both in direct space and in momentum space. Now, a squeezed vacuum state, a two-mode squeezed vacuum state, is analogous to this vacuum state, except that some of the spreading is shifted in a different direction. So you see here that, for instance, in this case, there is less fluctuation in with this one direction, but more in this direction, and it's the opposite in momentum space. So in that sense, one has a squeezed vacuum state, still centered on the origin, but the blob, the wave function in this state, is squeezed in one direction. There's a parameter characterizing the squeezing, this R here, the squeezing parameter, And with this parameter, one can write the two-mode wave function in one of those squeezed vacuum states as a superposition involving pairs of particles, or quanta, one in each mode, weighted by this coefficient here, which, because it has just a single parameter, the squeezing parameter comes as powers, really. And so this is the structure of the bipartite state. Now, suppose that you were able to measure only one of the two oscillators in this problem, maybe A, maybe B. If you were, you would describe this situation here by taking the trace of that state over the other mode. And as you do that, what you get is the reduced density matrix, say for A, which takes this form. Now it's the state for a one-mode system, but it's not pure anymore. It's mixed, as you can see. And it's not only mixed, but actually thermal. You can recognize here this coefficient here coming with a power as corresponding to a Boltzmann distribution over these modes. And so in other words, if one considers a two-mode vacuum state and traces over part of that system, one ends up for the partner with a thermal state with a temperature that's directly determined by the squeezing parameter. And indeed, the higher the squeezing, the higher the temperature. This is exactly what happens in the Hawking process. Gravitational collapse, as we said, produces exponential redshifts, which slow down the dynamics of the field very rapidly. As they do that, they produce pairs of particles in two-mode vacuum states. Only half of those particles escape to infinity where we might observe them. And as we only observe half of the system, this two-mode vacuum state, which it really is, appears to us as a thermal state with an exact temperature, which is given by the squeezing parameter. In the Hawking effect, the temperature is given by the squeezing parameter of the black hole, which is its surface gravity. And so the surface gravity produces a thermal distribution of photons in the outgoing sector of the theory. This is my understanding, as simple as I could get it, of the physics of the Hawking phenomenon. That there is indeed physics in this problem is illustrated by the sort of intense experimental activity there is these days in producing those two-mode vacuum states. This is just a sample of activity surrounding the production of two-mode vacuum states and its detection. This is a field that's sometimes called analog gravity or analog black holes, because indeed, any one of those two-mode vacuum states is in many ways a form of Hawking radiation. And so if you can produce and detect those states, then you are really in some ways detecting Hawking radiation. At least that is the rationale for this field of physics. One way is by shaking an effective mirror in the vacuum. This is called the dynamical Casimir effect. And it can be actually done these days with squids. But you can also have phenomena that are very analogous to Hawking radiation in optical fibers, in nonlinear optics, or using BECs, or using hydrodynamics. I think Silke Weinfurter is visiting us at the moment, and I'm sure she can tell you more about hydrodynamical versions of this Hawking emission process. So this was just to remind us of the actual physics surrounding this entire topic of two-mode vacuum states and Hawking radiation. It's not just speculation, it's actual experimental physics. Now, getting back to the story of black holes, let me wrap up what I just said. A black hole, as it forms when it collapses, it excites radiation from the vacuum in the form of two-mode vacuum states, two-mode squeezed vacuum states. The outgoing part of that flux, the flux that we receive as asymptotic observers, is thermal, and it's given by a temperature that is related to the squeezing parameter of the black hole, which is its surface gravity proportional to the inverse of its mass. But of course, that flux carries energy with it, and so we expect the black hole to lose its mass accordingly. And the lost race, what was computed by Hawking, of course, in the celebrated 74 paper, and suggests that the following equation, the following differential equation for the mass of an evaporating black hole. This is an equation in which the right-hand side is very small, and so it's a very slow process. But still, it's a puzzling process which begs the question, what about the final state of a black hole? When it keeps evaporating all its mass, what happens next? This is really sort of the key question, the key open question that is opened by Hawking's computation of black hole evaporation. I'm adding here Archimedes, and this is the first time he's appearing on these slides, and he will appear again as a reminder of the speculative nature of the mass loss phenomenon here. Everything I've said so far is pretty much well grounded in physics, but the inference that this will indeed let the black hole shrink until it becomes small, part of it is speculative, and I just would like to remember that element of speculation in this slide by the presence of Archimedes here. So whenever you see Archimedes in my slides, it will mean that something in the slides is speculative. So let's step back and try and just reflect upon what we've learned from the Hawking process. And yeah, sure.
I haven't understood exactly what speculative. You're saying that the radiation is established.
I would say
so
the radiation
energy loss is established, but you're saying it's not established that as a consequence of that the black hole mass goes down.
That's my understanding. Yeah.
So what are the
of course
what
of
are
course.
The alternatives?
No, that I'm saying it's not being measured. This is a back reaction phenomenon of the sort that is not being done in the lab. That's not being measured. Energy conservation suggests that if energy is coming out from space-time, the space-time should lose this energy in some form. But how that happens is not well understood, I would say. And so to say that the black hole will lose its mass until it becomes small, part of this is speculative. I mean, of course, this follows from energy conservation. I very much agree with this. So Archimedes is not here to say that it's wrong. It's just a hint, a grain of salt, that I think in this field I find for myself useful to just keep in mind. That's all I'm trying to say. So let's reflect upon the lessons of the Hawking evaporation phenomenon for black holes and irreversibility. It would seem that it contradicts essentially all the lessons that we drew from classical general relativity. First of all, there was the no-hair theorem. But Hawking radiation is here in the sense that it is a feature of a black hole that is not accounted for by the two parameters of the Kerr family, the mass and spin of the black hole. Second, we saw the area law, the statement that the area of a black hole can only increase. Well, if mass loss is correct and the black hole actually shrinks under Hawking evaporation, then this will be a case of the area of a black hole actually decreasing in time. How is that possible? Well, it's possible because Hawking evaporation involves locally negative energy densities, and those are excluded by the assumptions of the area theorem. So when I talked about normal matter, I meant positive energy density matter, but the energy that gets produced from the vacuum in Hawking evaporation is not everywhere of local positive energy density, and this is how it's possible to actually have violations of the area theorem. And thirdly, there was the discussion surrounding singularities in their nature, but it is tempting to speculate that quantum mechanics could resolve those singularities a little bit in the same way in which it does resolve the sort of Coulomb potential singularity through, as we say heuristically, the uncertainty principle, the fact that an electron can never be localized on the proton, and so because of this uncertainty principle, the stability of atoms is established. Similarly, one could imagine that quantum mechanics would resolve the singularity in the black hole through some form of quantum repulsion, and in that case, there wouldn't be singularities again. Once more, an assumption that goes into the classical singularity theorem is the positivity of energy densities, which is not the case in the presence of the Hawking process. So the question arises, I think, does quantum mechanics actually restore reversibility? If it just sort of contradicts all those elements of irreversibility, it is worth asking whether quantum mechanics restores reversibility. Let's get back to the picture of the Hawking process and view it in a slightly different way from a different angle. Again, this is the picture of a wave that would be coming from an incipient black hole, getting redshifted in time. If we think of the structure of the quantum vacuum, which couples to gravitational collapse, as an entangled structure, so that correlations in the vacuum from one point to the next are actually correlated, then because of this stretching effect, we expect short-range entanglement to be turned in collapse into long-range entanglement. And so there is here sort of a threshold where gravitational collapse happens, and so this is shaking the vacuum in some way, and it can produce long-range entanglement. This is in some ways analogous to what condensed matter physicists call a quantum quench. That's, I think, a good entry point into the structure of quantum reversibility. And indeed, it has been argued as such. And so let us pursue this view of entanglement, as telling us something about reversibility. So I recall that in quantum mechanics, one defines entanglement entropy for a bipartite system, or a system that has two components, let's say, A and B, as a measure of the entanglement that there is, as a measure of the correlations that there is between A and B. How one constructs this quantity is by considering the reduced state of A when one ignores the state of B, just like we said previously with the two-mode vacuum squeezed state. And so one forms the reduced density matrix for A when tracing over B and computes the von Neumann entropy of that reduced density matrix. This is a quantity that measures correlations between A and B, and it satisfies the following triangle inequality that you can read off here. One thing it says in particular is that if the combined system AB is in a pure state, then the entropy of A and the entropy of B should be the same, so that really entanglement entropy between A and B is a measure of correlations rather than a measure of A or a measure of B. It's a measure of the correlations between A and B. It's symmetric in A. And furthermore, it's bounded from above by this quantity here, which together with this condition here implies that the entanglement entropy as a function of the size of the subsystem A is a quantity that will first grow as A becomes larger and larger, roughly half the size of the total system. And as it grows more by symmetry, then entanglement entropy must go down because now the small system is B. And so it will get smaller and smaller. And so entanglement entropy will first go up and then down as a function of the size of the subsystem A. This is a quantity that's very well defined in quantum mechanics and that was proposed as a useful concept for understanding black holes by Raphael Sorkin here in the room. A very useful proposal that has led to much thinking and much improvement of the concept of entanglement entropy. In the case of radiation coming from a black hole, if I'm going to use this definition, I should be clear about what the subsystem is. And I'll define the subsystem as radiation as perceived from asymptotic observers, therefore far from the hole, up until some time t. So if this is again a picture of what happens to the field in gravitational collapse, I can consider a subsystem as everything before a given time and consider the entanglement entropy of that quantity with the rest. Early radiation, if you will, as it is entangled with late radiation. So if we take our cues from finite dimensional quantum mechanics, one should expect probably that entanglement entropy of radiation, radiation entropy, will first grow in a first phase and then reach a maximum. That maximum will correspond to what's been called the page time because of Don Page, who studied this curve very early on. And perhaps then of a second phase in the evaporation process where the radiation coming from the hole becomes purifying for the radiation that was there before. So this curve here should be thought of as strictly analogous to this curve here. But this curve here is rigorous. This one is a conjecture. It is conjectured by Don Page. And I think it is fair to call it an outstanding open conjecture in semi-classical gravity to understand whether this is indeed the picture that arises in black hole evaporation. The part that's not contentious is the first part, the growth of entanglement entropy in the early stages, corresponding to radiation coming from a black hole that's actually thermal. To check this, one can make the proposal rather precise by making approximations of the field dynamics. Yeah, Raphael.
If you go back, I wonder if it should be called a conjecture in semi-classical gravity, because in semi-classical gravity you can do the computation and this doesn't happen.
Right.
Maybe it's a conjecture in deep quantum gravity or something.
Fair enough. Semi-classical gravity / quantum gravity. This comment that you just made is especially relevant for the late stages, of course, of evaporation. It is not impossible that there is a semi-classical description of the whole process. There are models in two dimensions, such as some versions of the CGHS model in two dimensions, where one finds that the field is in a state with low, the metric and the field is in a state with low fluctuations all around the black hole except a region near the black hole itself. I'm referring here to computations by Ashtekar and collaborators. And so it would seem in this scenario that the strongly non-classical regime region is near the black hole itself, but apart from it, it is not. And so you could perhaps extend semi-classical gravity all around the black hole, including in the future, provided you just excise this black hole region. So that semi-classical gravity should be ruled out entirely in the late stage is not clear, but it is absolutely a possibility. And the remainder of...
You're still ruling it out because you're saying near the black hole. There's none.
That's right. Near the black hole or perhaps near the would-be singularity. It is not clear where semi-classical gravity breaks down. If it's near a singularity, at earlier stage, there are proposals, and it is a conversation, I would say, in the community to decide where exactly semi-classical gravity breaks down, if it does. So this is a useful clarification. Thank you. So to make this a little bit more concrete, it's useful to make approximations, somewhat drastic approximations, but approximations nonetheless, in treating the field as really a two-dimensional field in the time radius part of space-time. So what this means is you consider a space-time, a black hole space-time, that's spherically symmetric, and you neglect multiple moments in the field, only S waves. You restrict to the S wave sector of the field. And furthermore, you neglect what's called backscattering, which corresponds to the interaction of the field with the gravitational potential outside the black hole. Rafael, you had another question. If you do that, but don't assume necessarily that the structure of spacetime, the geometry of spacetime, is close to that of a static classical black hole, so you allow for a back reaction, if not for backscattering, then you can obtain a simple geometric formula for radiation entropy as a function of time as seen from outside observers. In this process of constructing this formula, a subtraction procedure is required because entanglement entropy is usually divergent in field theory. And so there is a need for subtract vacuum contributions. So what I'm writing here is renormalized entropy corresponding to the entropy of entanglement in the field in radiation between early and late radiation minus the entanglement you'd have anyway in the vacuum. So you can think of this as excess in entanglement entropy, excess with respect to the vacuum state. For a massless field, you find this simple formula here, where the effect of the background is captured by this term here, called gravitational redshift, and which one can think of as the ratio of the frequency of a wave that goes into the 2B black hole, comes back just before the black holes form, and comes out with a frequency that's shifted with respect to its initial frequency, omega naught. So omega of t is a redshifted frequency. And so comparing the out frequency with the in frequency, one gets this gravitational redshift. Okay, this is, of course, based on seminal work by Holtze and collaborators in 1994. And it allows to actually make computations of the Page curve in some settings that are exact. So this is what I want to show you now, how knowing or assuming or making an ansatz for the geometry of an evaporating black hole, one can actually compute the Page curve. So I don't want to spend too much time on this, just to tell you that the approach that's being taken here is that of an ansatz, again, for the geometry of space-time. And so one just decides what the geometry might be, and from then computes the Page curve, or the entanglement entropy as seen from asymptotic observers. One can consider different scenarios to build up intuition as to what might happen. One scenario that's sort of useful to look at as a sort of toy model is that of what we call an epsilon star. And an epsilon star is just a star that collapses, but for some magical reason, just before it crosses its own event horizon, stops there at a radius epsilon from the Schwarzschild radius. So this is something that, seen from outside, will look like a black hole for a very long time. And indeed, the entanglement entropy in the field will grow linearly for a time. But then, of course, will return to its initial value. So this is like a transient version of the Hawking phenomenon. And the smaller epsilon, the longer this transient evaporation phase. This is a case where you can get something that looks like a Page curve, monotonic first, reaching a maximum and then down, but in a very artificial situation. Another case you can consider is the case that Hawking first considered, where the black hole evaporates completely, leaving behind nothing. In that case, the event horizon will have an endpoint, after which space-time is just not determined by what's inside the black hole. What you get here is a curve that grows, so it seems that it's not smooth, but it's actually smooth. It grows smoothly up until a finite time corresponding to this point where the black hole completely evaporates and then becomes infinite there. It just blows up there. Again, another artificial model which tells you, which helps provide insight into how a specific geometry can have an effect on the field. Okay. Another thing you can do is look at non-singular black holes. So those are models that are being proposed currently in the literature where one says, well, quantum mechanics has this repulsion effect that I mentioned, so that in fact there is no event horizon. In fact, the stuff that goes into the black hole later on comes out. Okay, so one can take this at face value as a proposal, as a nonsense for the structure of a space-time, a black hole space-time, and see how it couples to the field. What you get is a Page curve that indeed looks like it's monotonic and then decreasing, but one notable feature is that it doesn't remain positive. So there are points, a very short time, in which the entanglement in the field is actually lower than in the vacuum. So this is an example of a Page curve that's not positive definite. So those are computations of the Page curve, if one wants. But of course, I should stress that those are based on assumptions as to the effect of back reaction on the structure of space-time. So now, they're not really computations. They are more sort of insights into how geometry affects vacuum entanglement. And with this sort of background, one can ask questions regarding the reversibility, the quantum reversibility of the Hawking process. One can ask, well, is it unitary in the sense that is the purity of the vacuum preserved in the process? This is what's known as the information loss problem that has been much discussed and much investigated in literature. But there's another question that one might ask, and that's whether the process is cyclic, what I'm calling cyclic, which is the feature that the entanglement entropy at late times is the same as it was at early times, with the definition that I gave. Okay, so this condition here. There's another aspect that one should keep in mind, and that's that input and output energy in this space-time should match. Whatever mass and energy goes into the formation of the black hole, it can maybe come out of the black hole, but not more can come out of a black hole than was actually put in. So this is a constraint that will turn out to be useful. More importantly, what difference would all of this make if information was lost or not lost, if the process was cyclic or not cyclic? I want to try and just put my finger on what physical difference it would make for observers that are standing far from the black hole and just observing it from far.
I don't understand the equation S plus infinity equals S minus infinity. What are those S's referred to? What entanglement are you talking about at the end of the process and at the beginning?
In the field, with this definition.
I mean, normally it's between the inside and outside of the black hole.
Mm-hmm.
Your black hole is gone, so.
So I'm taking the perspective of asymptotic.
You just mean the effective entropy of what the residual radiation that's still present in the asymptotic region.
Yes, this is tracking the entropy in the field, from far. This is not the entropy that compares entanglement across the horizon. This is just this asymptotic perspective where one looks at radiation early versus radiation late.
Okay, and the initial entanglement entropy, you meant there's already a black hole present at that time? Or are you talking about a time before it was formed?
Before it was formed.
So what entanglement? So you just mean the total energy. I see. You just mean if the field had been in a thermal state before it formed, for example.
No, I'm saying,
or
I'm
some,
imagining
some
that
state
it's...
that had entropy, it equals the entropy at the end of the process. Is that?
Yes, that's right. But the assumption I'm making in this context here is that the initial state of the field is a vacuum.
So it should be zero then?
Yeah.
So this S minus infinity is 0?
Yeah.
Oh.
Provided you're using this particular renormalization. Whether it's 0 or minus 3 or plus 7 depends on what you choose as renormalization scheme, of course, which is why I wasn't writing it in this formula here. But if you take as definition of 0 for entanglement entropy the vacuum value, then this is saying that the entropy should go back to 0, which is what is being assumed here, where the entropy goes back to the same value it had initially.
Do you think there's an ambiguity in the definition of entropy for the vacuum?
It's infinite. So what is being looked at here is excess above the vacuum. That is how I'm taking this picture here. The entanglement entropy in the vacuum between two regions.
Between two regions, right. Well, maybe we can talk later. But
sure.
I haven't quite... All right. Are you going to, in the end of the... In your S plus infinity, are you taking two regions again? I'm talking about the entanglement across.
So I'm considering some space-time and asymptotic observers near scry plus, near future null infinity. And I'm considering an entangling surface corresponding to a retarded time u.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at entanglement across that time. So when u goes to minus infinity, it is the entanglement structure of the vacuum at early times. And when u goes to plus infinity, it's the entanglement structure at late times. And when I talk about cyclicity, I ask whether this entanglement here is the same as this entanglement here.
I see. So you're holding that surface fixed,
yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
At some fixed radius.
That's right. And what I vary is the time of observation based on this intuition here. So I want to just stress quickly that unitarity does not imply cyclicity. You can have acyclic processes that are perfectly unitary. An example would be a moving mirror, which would reflect the vacuum in different ways in the past and in the future, so that the entanglement between two sort of neighboring rays in the past and in the future is different. So in that case, one would find a shift in entanglement entropy between the past and the future, corresponding to the rapidity of the mirror, finally, with respect to its initial motion. So in other words, because of those UV divergences and the fact that one subtracts a reference point, in field theory, unitarity does not imply cyclicity. This is a case where evolution is perfectly unitary, but the final entanglement is larger than the initial entanglement. Now, one can investigate whether there is a more useful way to study this process, one that's not starting from an assumption about space-time and treating it as providing sort of a background for quantum fields, but the other way around, understanding how constraints from quantum field theory can tell us something about space-time. So one way to do this is an identity which relates the energy flux as perceived by asymptotic observers with entanglement entropy and its derivatives with respect to time. So this is a useful identity which in some ways generalizes the so-called generalized second law in the sense that it's an identity rather than an inequality. Of course, it has a different flavor because it doesn't involve entanglement across the event horizon. It's a different notion of entanglement. But one can make the case that it has sort of the same physical content and is a little bit more general. It has this non-adiabatic term which allows it to be an identity rather than an inequality. It does not require special causal structure. It doesn't require an event horizon to be there. And you can check that it implies sort of the GSL and spherical symmetry. But I'm passing quickly on this because I see that time is running late. Just to tell you that from this identity here, which I like to call it from bit, because the right-hand side here is entropy, so it's bit, and the left-hand side is energy flux, so it's watts, if you like, so it's it. And from this it from bit identity, you can derive several consequences based on assumptions about the structure of the vacuum at late times. So if you assume that evaporation is a cyclic process for which the entanglement in the future in the vacuum is the same as it was in the past, then you find, first of all, that the black hole must have a gasping phase. And a gasping phase is a time when the energy flux coming from the black hole must be negative. And you see this because if that would correspond to the page time, the maximum of the entropy curve. Because indeed, if there's a maximum, this first derivative will vanish there. The second derivative will be negative because it's a maximum. And so at this particular point, the energy flux from the black hole will have to be negative. So in other words, instead of being monotonically decreasing, the mass of the event, the mass of the black hole will have a point in which it will increase again before eventually decreasing. Such as what happens when somebody dies, some physiologists talk of the last gasp, which corresponds to a phase just before dying of inhaling and getting a little bit more mass than you had. So this is a sort of picture of what might happen. Another thing that you can derive easily from this it from bit identity is a constraint on the duration of the purification phase, provided energy is conserved, provided not more energy comes out from the black hole that was sent into it. So you can get an inequality here, a lower bound on the purification time, which involves the initial mass of the black hole, as well as the mass at the end of the thermal phase. And with that inequality, you find that the right-hand side, in all cases, is a very large time. So that purification, if energy is going to be conserved, will have to be slow. This is in contrast with many models that are being discussed at the moment in the literature, where purification happens in a burst. Just at the end, you get one burst of purifying energy. This is not consistent with cyclicity and energy conservation. In fact, this burst comes at an energy cost which is larger than is available in the resources of the black hole. So I think it's useful to keep this in mind and sort of investigate a little bit more whether it's actually possible, rather than having many, many different options, whether there is one good spherically symmetric semiclassical space-time for which entanglement in the future is the same as entanglement in the past, so it's a cyclic process in the sense that I defined, and the mass of the black hole never becomes negative, which is another way of saying that energy is conserved. Another way of saying that there is not more energy coming out from the black hole than once put in the black hole. So it's a really interesting open question, which is lying at the bottom of understanding how semi-classical geometry and quantum fields would interact with one another. I think this is my concluding slide, that if we reflect upon what physics has to tell us about the black hole process, first of all, we have classical general relativity, which suggests that black holes, in some ways, break reversibility. And I hope I have explained in what ways it does, and the sense I mean by this phrase. But on the other hand, it looks like quantum effects may restore reversibility, either by enforcing unitarity or this sort of different and perhaps stronger condition of cyclicity. And I think working with this as an assumption and back engineering the structure of the space-time that might have these features is interesting. And in that respect, 2D field theory, which I have sort of sketched for you, helps us imagine what this might mean physically. One thing it might mean is black hole gasping, sort of a feature of purification as seen from asymptotic observers. Slow purification is another one. Those are, of course, very speculative, and so Archimedes is really quite excited here, because those are very speculative, but they help us provide intuition into this conundrum of quantum mechanics as perhaps providing a resolution of reversibility in field theory. For more details, I encourage you to listen to a more technical talk that I gave recently, and that's available online, as well as the papers, and I know it's a little bit late, so I thank you for your patience and your attention in this talk. Thank you.